On my last night in Paris, I found myself lost and alone in a tunnel 60 feet below the city in the pitch black, armed only with the smallest flashlight in the world. That's right, the smallest flashlight in the world. I thought I was going to die. I've written a new book, an adventure story set in Paris. It's called Crowdsourcing Paris. Because it wasn't enough to visit Paris, I had to have an adventure there too. In fact, I had 12 adventures, including a visit to the 170 miles of illegal caves, tunnels, and catacombs beneath the city. In the book, I bring you along to one of the most beautiful cities in the world as I go to places most tourists never see. Because you shouldn't just visit Paris, you should have an adventure in Paris. Crowdsourcing Paris, Memoirs of a Paris Adventure, coming to Amazon and Barnes & Noble on October 22nd. I'm here to be a catalyst for awe. You are a character in your life. So what kind of story are you telling? Is it any good? Or is it kind of boring? Let's put it to the test. This is Character Test with Joe Bunting. Welcome to the Character Test Show, my podcast about the characters we love and hate in the books we read, the films we watch, and the lives we lead. My name is Joe Bunting, and I'm a best-selling author and the founder of The Right Practice.
And I'm Alice Sudlow. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Right Practice and the StoryGrid certified editor.
As always today, we're going to start by putting a character to the test. Alice and I look at a character in a book we're reading or film we're watching and ask, is this actually a good character? And also, what can we learn from that character? Which character are we talking about today, Alice?
We're doing something a bit unusual for us. We're taking on multiple characters because Joe didn't want to pick just one of them. Today, we're talking about every single character from the TV show Blue Bloods, which is currently streaming on Netflix. Is that right? We're talking about literally all of them?
Not every single one, but like five of them.
Okay. A solid crowd.
After that, we're talking to magician Nate Stanforth. Nate is best known as a magician. He co-hosted a Discovery Channel show called Breaking Magic. He has a YouTube channel and performs a magic show all over the US. He is also the author of Here Is Real Magic, a memoir about how he fell in love with magic, how he became a professional magician, how he got burnt out, and then rediscovered his love for magic by traveling to India to see street magicians. It's a great book. In this interview, we talk about wonder, why, what it is, why it's important, and how we lose access to it as we get older and how to reconnect with it. If you've ever thought, why as adults don't we have the same ability to experience true joy and wonder, this interview is for you. The last part of our show is our character study, where we ask what we can learn in our own lives as we try to live a better story. Thanks for listening to the Character Test Show. We have a free prize for everyone who listens to this episode. I'm not going to tell you what it is, though, so you have to find out for yourself. You can get it at charactertestshow.com/episode14. Again, go to charactertestshow.com/episode14 to get a free prize related to this episode. All right. Alice, it's time for our character test portion of our show. Today, we're examining the characters from Blue Bloods.
That's right. And I have never actually seen this show. So could you give, really, me personally, a rundown of what all the show is about? Also our listeners, but mostly me.
Of course. So the show follows a family of police officers in New York City. There's the grandpa, Henry Reagan, who is the former police commissioner. There's the dad, Frank Reagan, played by Tom Selleck. He is the current police commissioner. Frank's kids, Aaron, who is a New York City prosecutor. Danny, played by Donnie Wahlberg. He is a detective in major crimes. And Jamie Reagan, who's my favorite. He went to law school at Harvard, but instead of becoming a lawyer, he decides to join the family business. When the show starts, he has just graduated from the academy. Behind the scenes, the family is still reeling from the loss of another son, Joe, who is also a cop, but he was killed in a shooting. So it's a typical crime drama with some type of crime at the beginning of the episode, usually a murder happening, which Danny investigates. At the same time, Frank, as the police commissioner, deals with internal politics in the force and in New York City. Danny investigates the crimes, Aaron prosecutes them, and we watch Jamie kind of try to climb the rungs of his career. It's pretty fun.
I'm going
to
be honest, I'm really glad that I have this almost as a cheat sheet written down in front of me, because that was a lot of characters, and it is helpful for me to be able to see this.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a family drama, which is sort of what's fun about the show. My wife and I have been binging on this show on Netflix. We're like 5 seasons in. Neither of us are really crime drama people.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fun about this is how the family comes together nearly every episode over the dinner table to talk about all of the things that they're experiencing and kind of process it. And it sort of brings this cool dynamic into that crime drama space.
It does sound really interesting to have a crime drama that's also heavily family-centric, kind of the meshing of two genres.
Yeah, and it's fun to see how the siblings interact, how they interact with the grandfather, who's kind of a character. All of it is pretty fun.
Nice. So let's put the family to the test using our 4 criteria for what makes an interesting character, starting with the goal. Does the family or the individuals in this family, the individual characters, do they have a goal? And what are those goals?
Yeah, so I'm going to blitz through all of these people. I think the family's goal as itself is just to stay together. They've lost their mom, who died of cancer fairly, you know, before the show, but fairly recently they lost their brother. And so it's just, how do they stay close in the middle of their very intense jobs? The grandpa's goal is to support his family, also to relive his glory days. He's retired. He's kind of sometimes trying to enmesh himself back in the family business. But then there's Frank. He has the most expansive goal, I would say, which is really just to protect everyone, the whole city of New York, but especially his family. And that's something he failed at very recently when his son died in a shooting. Danny's goal is to solve each case. He always gets really emotionally invested in each of the cases. He also likes to win at everything. He's very competitive. Aaron's goal is to put the bad guys away, to win cases, but also she's a single mom, recently divorced. It's to raise her daughter well in the midst of that difficult situation for her. And Jamie's goal is really to become the kind of cop that would make his family proud, really to kind of enter into the legacy of his family, especially to be like his brother, Joe, who died, his elder brother.
Nice. So they all have collective goals and individual goals. Do they have to overcome challenges to accomplish those goals? What challenges are they? And do their goals ever come in conflict with each other?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So they all deal with challenges. I think every crime that they deal with is a new challenge. Some of those crimes, like 3 of them are working on at once, which is sort of fun. And when that happens, like you definitely see a lot of conflict with each other. Like Aaron will decide not to prosecute a case that Danny is working on. And then they kind of butt heads. And then Jamie is new to the business, family business, new to being a cop. And he's kind of looking up to his brother, Danny, but also feeling like, you know, he wants to do a few things differently than his brother. And also he doesn't have the skills. He's not like, hasn't proved himself, and Danny gives him a hard time. So there's definitely a lot of sibling rivalry in there, which is fun. Dealing with the legacy of their brother who died, I think, is a big challenge. And then Frank especially is dealing with kind of the higher level political issues around the police in New York City. And sometimes he'll like enter into the cases as well if he has a connection.
So good characters make decisions. That's a really critical part of an interesting character. Do these members of this family make decisions? And are there any collective family decisions that they make kind of as a whole unit?
Yeah, that's good. I think the writers do a really good job of making sure all of the characters are involved in every episode. They're all making decisions in every episode. The grandpa gets involved. Sometimes he gets involved in ways that aren't great. And it's kind of awkward. I mean, he's trying to relive the glory days a lot of times. Sometimes it's not a good thing for him to get involved. But sometimes when he does get involved, he makes a big difference just because he has a different connections, different way of thinking about things. Frank's decisions are always kind of about like doing the right thing, even if it's not the expedient thing, the political thing. So he's always making decisions around there. Danny, I think, makes the most decisions. He might be the protagonist, if there is one in this story. He is taking a lot of the action, solving a lot of the cases. So he's making a lot of like detailed decisions, like, do I go right? How do I catch this bad guy who's running? And Erin's making decisions about prosecuting. She's also making some parenting decisions that are, I think, really relatable for her parents. And Jamie, he makes a major decision at the beginning of this story to abandon his plan of becoming a lawyer. He went to Harvard Law to become a lawyer, and he instead decides to become a cop. And I think that kind of sheds a whole light on the family business.
Yeah, it does really sound like a family business and how they're all involved in it. So the really big question, the kind of culminating question here is, are these characters that we can empathize with?
I do think they're all empathizable. All of them usually are trying to do the right thing. They're all bringing their own perspective too. And sometimes they disagree with each other. So one person is harder on a case. The other is kind of more empathizing with the person being tried in the case. So you're kind of taking these two different perspectives. Sometimes you agree with one person, sometimes you agree with another. But together, like as a family, it's hard to not like them. I think we have the hardest time empathizing with Danny because he can be a little rough around the edges, kind of mean, sometimes actually mean. Some people might relate to that because he does get results, but I think for me, it makes him a little hard to empathize with. But at the same time, they do a good job of developing his character. He has PTSD from serving in Iraq, which brings him a little bit more empathy. I also think that there's plenty to critique here in the characters, in the family, in the show. They have a specific point of view that cops are usually the good guys. And, you know, over the last 10 years in our nation's history, there have been some really important critiques about the police. So it's interesting to see inside a family who are trying to do the right thing most of the time. And, you know, there's things to critique and there's things to understand about that too. And it's fun for the most part.
For sure. Yeah. So last question is, what can we learn from them?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from them. They're all very protective. I mean, I don't think you can have a family of police officers, four generations of police officers, without being protective. And I think, you know, how do you have that mentality to protect the people around you? So that's something we can learn from them. How to take action in really intense, heated situations, how to make those split second decisions. And also in the midst of all that, how to stay close as a family. They're very intentional with each other. They really rely and support each other. So I think just that idea of like, how do you stay close as a family in the midst of everything crazy going on in life? And how do you also process all the hard things in your life with your family? I think that's an important part that
yeah.
we can learn.
I will say I tease you about the fact that rather than picking one character, you picked an entire cast. But I can also see why this tests really well together as a yeah. collective, because it sounds like as this family unit, they kind of all represent different facets and approaches to, in a sense, they are all definitely individual characters. In a sense, there's also like this collective family as a character mm-hmm. almost. And so having them all kind of represent facets of yeah. a sort of collective experience is a really neat way to approach storytelling and to approach life, because we all have that kind of element in our lives.
Yeah. I mean, what would it look like for a family's work to be about justice?
Yeah.
And how would that family actually work? And what would their dysfunctions be too?
Right.
And
for
you see
sure.
their dysfunctions pretty clearly too. And in the midst of that, they still find a way to stay together. So it's good.
Yeah. Where does it work? Where does it break down? And how do they hold it together throughout? All right, I guess I'm passing the judgment of pass-fail character test here. Based on all this discussion, I say yes, they passed the test.
Awesome, I agree.
Perfect. Well, then that's it for Blue Bloods. Let's get into our interview.
All right, welcome to the Character Test Show, Nate. Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
So I'd like to start with a section from your book, Here is Real Magic. And there's a section toward the beginning where you're reflecting on what first drew you to magic as a kid. There were kind of a couple of memories that you had that really reflected what magic was for you. Can you read that section from your book?
Sure. And just to put this into context, I'm a young boy and my parents have driven my brother and sister and I out in the middle of a cornfield to watch a meteor shower. Then the meteor shower began. My dad led us up a low hill and laid the blankets on the wet grass. I don't remember how long we all lay there, watching the sky, but I became aware for the first time that the entire planet, the oceans, London, Mount Everest, everything, lay directly and totally behind me. Somehow the night sky had unveiled the true nature of this road, mistaken during the day as a gravel route through a cornfield, but revealed now as the final patch of earth at the very edge of the world. That night, the mystery of our situation felt like one grand miracle, hidden just out of sight unless you really try to see it. That there is something rather than nothing, and that we are here to be a part of it. Surely this is amazing. How is this so easy to forget? How is this so easy to ignore, silence, or overlook in the pursuit of other things? Even at a young age, we learn the universe is filled with loneliness and fear, but lying there, clinging to the blanket as the earth spun and the meteors fell and the whole of existence stood out on display, I recognized that whatever else it was and whatever I became in it, the universe was also filled to the very cusp with wonder.
Oh, I love that passage so much. First of all, I just want to say how unfair it is that you're such a good writer. I had to go to college and study creative writing, read hundreds, thousands of books, write for years, but you are a professional musician and still this is just so good.
But I would say that I did that too. Like when I was on tour with my work as a magician, I read like a crazy person. And you know, just you can only play so many games on your phone. Like that gets boring within the first 6 weeks of touring. Yeah. And I've done this for over a decade. And so at the beginning it was just, you know, I started reading for that reason. I needed something to do in the airplanes and on the, you know, backstage before the show and at the hotel room afterwards. But I mean, you know how it is with reading. You get hooked and then it's like you've discovered this trap door, not to one hidden world, but to a whole library full of hidden worlds. And yeah. And then the same with writing. When I came home from India, I was really worried that I couldn't say everything that I wanted to say just with my craft of magic and being a magician. And so I thought, okay, I better learn how to write, and just tackled it the way that I had learned. You know, I don't mean to spoil anything for your listeners, but I don't have magic powers, right? Like everything I ever do on stage is just the product of working harder than I think a person might think a magician would be willing to work on magic. And so, that was a long answer to a short question.
I love it. How did it feel to write like that? I mean, you are sitting down at your computer or writing by hand and you're putting out these words. How did it feel for you to write like that?
I mean, I really didn't enjoy the writing process at all. I love having written it. You know, I liked it when it was over, but I remember the process of writing this book as harrowing at best. Part of it's that my training is as a stage magician. And when you're on stage in front of an audience, you can tell right away whether you're connecting with them. And you don't have that as a writer. You have other clutches as a writer. And I don't know that one is harder than the other, but it took me a long time to get used to the fact that I could throw an entire day at this book and at the end not know if I'd come up with anything. You know, some days the only progress I would make was deleting what I wrote the day before. So I don't have a good answer to that. You know, some days felt good and some days felt miserable. And you do that for enough days in a row and you'll end up with a manuscript.
Well, I think it comes off as very easy and just beautiful. I mean, I love the book and it's amazing. I mean, the writing is amazing.
Thank you, Jim.
So thank you for writing it. Thank you for sharing it with the world. I'm so glad I found it.
I'm glad that you don't have the first draft in front of you. Let me tell you that.
Well, I think a lot of writers could say that.
Sure.
So I've never seen your show, but I've heard that there is this routine that you do where you ask people to hold their phones up. Can you tell us about that routine?
Let me answer that question like this. When many people imagine a magician on stage. Even today, the sort of popular image of a magician is someone with a top hat, right? Or, you know, pulling a rabbit out of a hat. That's like the stereotypical magic trick.
Yeah.
And the reason that's true is when magic entered the theater in the 1850s, this guy named Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin built a theater in Paris and was really the first one to take what had once, you know, what had usually been an art that was seen in the circus or in the sideshow or in fairs or festivals. Eugène Robert Houdin was the guy who brought it indoors and made it a theatrical event. And at that time, everyone was wearing top hats, right? So every magician knows that you have to meet the audience where they are, right? You have to find a way to connect the ideas and the material that you're doing with the people who are watching it. Otherwise, it doesn't resonate. And so Robert Houdin had this idea of borrowing a top hat from someone in the audience because they were ubiquitous. So it would feel like he was doing something with an item that was above suspicion just because everyone had one. And so the modern people don't wear top hats anymore, but everybody has a phone, right? So I'm not the only magician to figure out that, oh, if again, it's that same principle that he was using, meet the people where they are. But today's version of that is getting people to take their phones out. And so I hesitate to tell you what I do with it because so much of the power of that moment in particular in the show is that I'm doing something with a cell phone that people wouldn't normally consider doing with the cell phone. But the underlying idea is that it's using something as, you know, think of what a personal relationship we all have with our phones, right? It's an extension of almost every part of our life. And so if you can borrow someone's phone and mess with it a little bit, that can be a deeply unnerving experience. And I'm always looking for ways to make the audience feel as though they're off balance. Mm. And,
anyway, I know
you should
you don't
come to a show sometime.
I do want to come to a show. I know you don't want to give away your trick, or your illusion. But I think what you are doing in your work, it seems like points directly back to that moment under the stars and trying to share this feeling of wonder with people. Do you see that in your work? Like how do you bring people to that moment?
Yeah, that's the entire goal. I mean, I didn't become a magician because I wanted to be a performer. I don't even really like being that's something I had to make my peace with rather than something that I was drawn to initially. I love magic and I became fascinated with magic as a young boy because I discovered that when you do magic for someone, you get this response that is so charged with awe and wonder that it's almost inexplicable. I remember my first piece of magic as a young boy was just very simple. You put a coin in your hand and you close it. When you open your hand, the coin's gone. And I did this on the playground. And I mean, imagine for a moment that you don't know that you're watching a piece of magic, that you just see something disappear. You wouldn't applaud, right? You wouldn't laugh. You'd just start screaming and jumping up and down. And so the kids on the playground saw this quarter disappear and they didn't know they were seeing a trick. They just saw this kid make something disappear and they just lost it. And you know, this teacher came over to see what was going on and I showed the same thing to her. And I will remember the transformation on her face from this stern, authoritarian, dominating presence on the playground to, I mean, when the coin disappeared, it was like she was a little girl again. And that was far more amazing than the trick. And so my entire interest in magic was, why do people respond to this so strongly? And how can you use magic to share that experience of wonder? I think so often in our culture, it's dismissed as a sort of vapid, empty, you know, at its best, light entertainment, and at its worst, just a waste of time. But I think every magician can recognize those moments where it clearly can be more than that. So yeah, I'm chasing that as hard as I can.
How do you define wonder?
I don't know, Joe. I think it's some ratio of joy and fear, but I don't know quite what that ratio would be. I think when you're young, it's easy to be amazed, right? Because you are new and the world is new for you. And as you get older, it becomes harder and harder to connect with that. And so for me, wonder is the experience of reconnecting with that and remembering the way everything looked before it became ordinary.
Hmm. So you first decided that you wanted to learn about magic after reading Lord of the Rings, right?
You did your homework. Yeah, that's right.
I think you were 9 years old, right?
Oh, you read my book. That's what it is. Yeah.
So what was it about Lord of the Rings that made you want to learn magic?
I mean, I'm going to disappear pretty far down this rabbit hole for a second, but there's in the first section, the first, I believe it's the first chapter of the first book of Lord of the Rings. There's this character, Gandalf, if you haven't seen the movies or read the books, and he's a wizard and he goes to this birthday party, and at the birthday party, he does this magic that creates this giant firework magical dragon that swoops down above everyone at the party and terrifies them. They start screaming and running away. And I thought that would just be the greatest of all possible gifts to have. You know, to be able to do that on the playground, I would be unstoppable. And I love the idea of being unstoppable. So
why at 9 years old did you want to be unstoppable?
I mean, I think most 9 year olds could relate to that, but I remember for me, I was at a new school and I didn't feel at all that way. You know, I felt like I didn't know anybody, and I thought it would be a way to not just be the new kid, maybe. Mm. And anyway, I discovered that that's not how magic works. And then shortly after that, I discovered that it doesn't actually matter if the magic is real, if the audience doesn't know, you know, like if let me just try this with you. So let's say I made the coin disappear, but without using sleight of hand. Let's say I learned how to do it with real, actual magic. The audience would have responded in exactly the same way, right? Like when you see something that's impossible to explain, it just hits you in this visceral way. And that to me was deeply compelling. You know, what is going on there? How can I learn more about that?
You grew up in Iowa, right?
I did.
What was it like being a kid in Iowa and wanting to be a magician?
I mean, I think when your 9 year old says he's going to be a magician, it's cute. I think when your 19 year old says it, it's less cute, right? Because there's nobody from my town had ever done anything even remotely close to that. You know, even being a performer was unusual, but saying you're going to be a magician is like saying you're going to be a pirate. Like, nope, it's just impossible. And so, you know, I don't think anyone really knew what to make of me, but I think it was a tremendous advantage for me because for two reasons. And the first is that I didn't have any other examples to copy, right? Because at that time, it was before YouTube. It was before the internet was really popular. David Copperfield was on TV once a year, but I had never seen a magician perform until I had been performing myself. So I really had to find my own way of doing it rather than just copying what everyone else was doing. That was useful. Also, if the Boy Scouts wanted a magician for their banquet, or parents wanted a magician for their children's birthday parties, or the firemen wanted a magician for their end of year picnic, I was the only act in town. And so even before I was a teenager, I had already done so many shows. You know, I think in any art or any craft, there's a period where you're just irredeemably bad at the beginning, right? You're just terrible at it. But because I was the only magician, I got most of those shows out at a really, really young age. And so even by the time I was in high school, and I had already done so many shows that I felt like I knew how to handle myself on stage. And that has served me really well.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I think that's true for writing as well. It took me a lot of bad pages and even bad books before I really started to even understand what I was doing. And I still don't really understand. I mean, I think we're all still practicing even now, 10 years in. But that part about practicing your craft, I think, is so important. So that's what you did, right? You studied magic. It was kind of your sole focus for years, even through college. And then after college, you moved from the Midwest to Los Angeles. You rented out a theater and you started performing your show, right? Where did you get that idea to rent out a theater in LA?
I didn't know how other people did it. I didn't know how one started a career in professional magic. And I would say that in all of the arts, magic is maybe uniquely challenging in that way because there is no set career path. You know, if you're a band, there is an industry in place that will help you record. And if you're any good, then you get signed to a label. And then I'm sure it's more complicated than I think it is, but the number of bands who have made a living with their music is of orders of magnitude greater than the number of magicians who have done that. And so, same with comedy, same with acting, same with filmmaking. Magic didn't have any of that infrastructure in place. So I think even now, like, most magicians who make it have each had very different ways of making it. Mm. And so I always thought that if I just put on a good show, word would get around and people would come see it. The sort of, if you build it, they will come model. It just turns out that's not maybe the best business plan.
How did it go?
It was an unmitigated disaster. It was a failure in every way, except for the fact that it ended up working out. Essentially, no one came to see it, but it did.
How long did you perform that show?
3 months.
Oh my gosh! You were just like financing it. You were bankrolling it, renting.
I had been performing. Like, I saved all that money that I had earned doing magic. You know, like, I worked all through, you know, middle school and high school. Mm-hmm. It's just that my job was doing shows, and I did as many shows as I could. And I knew that at some point, okay, I'm going to have to make this jump.
Yeah.
So I rented the theater. I lived in a tiny, it wasn't even an apartment. It was a dorm for Japanese students studying English in Los Angeles. And yes, I think everyone talks about their starving artist phase, and that was certainly mine, but you know, I just didn't, did I didn't you do know any, how to make a show work. So
would you do any marketing for yourself, or I just kind of hope that people would come?
I spent $100 and printed 1,000 postcards talking about the show. And I went around to just about every coffee shop I could find and put one on the community bulletin board.
Wow.
I thought that would probably do it. And then I put an ad, a corner ad, like a $75 ad in LA Weekly 1 week. Announcing the start of the show.
Did it work?
No, it didn't work.
That's amazing.
But you know, I think the theater held 90 people, and my best audience, I think the fullest it ever was maybe 20 people.
Mm.
But I sort of got lucky. One of the nights someone came to see the show, and afterwards they came up to me and said, you know, you're an idiot for doing this. This isn't how it works, but let me see if I can help. And he took one of my postcards, and I still don't actually understand how all of the dots got connected, but I ended up getting signed on to do a college tour, which worked much better.
How did it feel when no one would show up to your show? Like, you have spent years by this point focused on learning your craft, on making the best show that you could, and then no one cared.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it's like spending years writing something that no one reads, you know? Like, I think I am not alone in having that experience. Think of how many artists have poured their life into a work only to have it go out to, you know, a dozen readers or a dozen viewers, or, you know, I think, you know, I don't know that that is ever an enjoyable experience. But I will say that summer in Los Angeles, like, I learned so much about magic, and I didn't have another job out there. My only job was this failing show, and I spent every second of my day either studying magic or inventing magic to put in the show. It would have been better if people had come to see it, but I didn't want to let the opportunity to learn from having this time slip away, and so I wouldn't say I enjoyed that time, but I did learn a tremendous amount about creating magic and inventing magic and putting it on stage. And
yeah, I mean, I resonate with that because there was a period in my life where things were really difficult with my writing and wasn't making very much money. And yet, like, for about a year, it was my only focus. Like, I was just all in. I was obsessed.
Yeah.
And now, 8 years later, things are going better for me financially. My writing's doing a lot better. I'm a better writer. I can do all of the work that I did before with less effort.
Yeah.
But there's still a nostalgia for that period. You know, I don't actually want to go back to that time and eat bad food and, you know, all the things that come with that period of time, you know, marginal poverty and all of those things. But the singularity of focus was so great.
Yeah.
You know, do you think about that time as kind of a bittersweet moment in your life?
I mean, I will say that I have tried to find that again in my own work.
Yeah.
You know, not just there, but in many times since. And for me, it's about like whenever I feel like maybe I've got a handle on something, right? Or I feel comfortable doing what I'm doing, that's a sign that it's time to go deeper or make it harder or find a way to readjust my sights to keep myself in that position of feeling like I'm a little bit in over my head and the only solution is to really pour everything that I have to give into the work, you know? It's really easy on tour when you're doing the same show every night to let it get comfortable and to let it get to feel like, oh, I'm getting really good at this. But I've noticed that like when I go back and look through my notebooks, I can see the times when I'm growing the most are when I recalibrate my sort of my expectations or recalibrate my target. So I'm aiming at something that I maybe couldn't have hit, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, but now, so it feels like I'm always chasing something. The bad shows are for me are when I feel like before I go on stage, I've got this, you know, I've done this 1,000 times. Whenever I can keep changing it just enough, so I feel like either I need to give all that I have to give or it's going to be a disaster. Like it doesn't necessarily lead to the most comfortable life. And it is a strange way to be alive. And maybe someday I'll retire and just not ever do it again. But like when I'm in it and when I'm really aiming for greatness as a magician, that's a trick I come back to over and over again. This idea of as soon as you feel comfortable, change. There's so that Bob Dylan line that just haunts me. And he said, he who is not busy being born is busy dying. Yeah. And I thought, oh man, oh, he's talking to me there. You know, I can learn from that.
This episode is brought to you by The Right Practice Pro. The Right Practice Pro is an amazing community of creative writers where you can post your writing, get feedback on it, and figure out how to turn your writing into beautiful, award-winning books, short stories, or novels. I personally post my own writing to this community to get feedback. And if you have any interest in becoming a published, award-winning writer, you should too. The Write Practice Pro is for anyone writing a book, novel, short story, or poem, or anyone who just wants to improve their creative writing. If you want to become a better writer, getting good feedback is something you must invest in. And the Write Practice Pro is the best place to get it. You can sign up for the Write Practice Pro at thewritepractice.com/join. So you seek out those kinds of situations strategically where you feel like you're over your head and you use that kind of to kind of reinvigorate your work, really.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say the book is an extension of that, you know? I really love that feeling of creative disorientation when you're working not from your training, but from your instincts. And I had reached a point as a magician where I had done, you know, I hit Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours the summer I turned 22. Like that is just a lot of time spent standing in front of a mirror practicing card tricks. And so part of the thought with the book was, is it possible to keep my aim in the same spot, but to just approach it from a different, totally different craft? Like if I can I do with language what I've been trying to do all along as a magician? And the result was about a year of just mind-numbing fear, you know, because it takes a long time to write something that's not just awful.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, as a magician, you one of the skills you learn is how to get better at things, because every trick is its own discipline. It's not like you learn a card trick. Learning a good card trick doesn't qualify you to learn or to do coin magic or to do a mind reading trick. Like each illusion is a different skill set. And so, you know, I have a routine that I do literally every day of things that I'm practicing and skills I'm developing. And so sliding writing into that process felt like, okay, if other people can do this, maybe I can do it too. I don't know that I have the gift for it, but with magic, you don't need a gift for it. You just sort of work harder than everybody else.
Yeah.
And so I thought, all right, let me try this.
And I think there's an aspect to that in writing too. And we were talking before we started recording just about how important it is to outlast everyone. I think for me, being a writer, there's a lot of people who want to be writers. Almost everyone I talk to thinks that they have a book in them. But to really make it as a writer, you have to have 10 books in you or more. You know, you have to outlast everyone.
And the question is not whether you want to be a writer, but whether you want to write, right? Like there's that Joe Lewis quote. He said, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And that speaks to me so much as a magician, because there are so many people who wish they could, so many people in my art of magic who want to do a stage show or they want to become professionals, but that doesn't mean they want to change their life. They don't want to put in the time that is required to do that. They just want the end. And I think those people never make it, but the people who want the practice. Like the thing that I love is the practice and the performing, and that just sort of leads inevitably to a career. But
yeah, and maybe you could read this second section of your book. This is where you were on the road. You've been performing your magic for people in this show for, I think, 5 years, on the road all the time, and you're kind of reaching a breaking point. And you're in the middle of this one show and everything just falls apart. And it's one of my favorite moments in the book, but maybe you could read that section and we can talk more about it.
And so again, just to put this in context, I had been touring for 5 years and was totally burned out. And one night on stage in the middle of the show, I realized all at once how lost I had become. So here it is. Do you want to know the real secret to becoming a great magician? It's very simple. You just have to care about it more than anyone else would ever consider possible. You give everything inside you to the work, night after night on stage and day after day in the studio or the workshop, where you pour your life into the slow, patient job of taking tricks and turning them into magic. The real work happens alone, in front of a mirror, practicing for hours on end, or in front of a drawing board or a notebook, designing a bridge strong enough to span the great distance between deception on one side and magic on the other. And if you do it right, when you take the stage, a show becomes an expression of the absolute highest that you have to offer. Do you want to be a great magician? Anyone can do it. All it takes is your life, your waking, breathing, hoping, hurting, day in, day out, life. But something had happened. I had gone back on my end of the bargain. I used to give everything I had to give on stage, as if my whole life hung in the balance. Now it just felt like a job. Somehow all of this had gone wrong. The room snapped back into focus. "I need to go," I announced. I was only 2/3 of the way through the show. "I hope you had a good time watching all of this, but I need to go. Good night."
I just love that section so much. And I think it really speaks to this tension that I think anyone who is in the arts feels, and really anyone who does anything that they care about feels, this tension between the work of your job, the part that's work, your craft, and also that kind of deeper thing that it's supposed to be about for you, the wonder that magic is supposed to inspire, the wonder that you got into magic in the first place.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my own work, I recently realized that I was totally disconnected from that kind of deeper power of my job, the reason why I wanted to become a writer in the first place. And it took me a waking up to that realization and trying to tap into kind of the source of my power as a writer. So what did you do? How do you rediscover kind of the wonder? How did you rediscover the wonder in your work?
You know, I think one of the problems that I had, one of the reasons I came to this point that felt like such a crisis, was that I was trying to have it both ways, right? I was trying to keep the touring operation going and still, you know, it's not like I didn't notice. Like I knew that it was miserable. I knew that I was not enjoying this at all. And what ultimately ended up happening for me was this process of, you know, it felt like I was quitting. It felt like I was walking away from all of it to make a clean break. And, you know, I remember thinking, I would rather stop this completely than go on in the way that I'm going. That I loved this too much and still loved it in my better moments. I loved it too much to do it in this way. And so I think my solution was maybe ridiculous as I think about it now. I ended up going on this adventure to the other side of the world to study another culture's approach to magic. But having done that, I think a couple of things, Joe. I think that it's really easy to get lost in the business of a craft. You know, when you take something that you started doing because you loved, and then you make that your income or your way of making a living, that puts a pressure on it that maybe it can't always sustain. And one of the reasons I wanted to get away from performing on stage was because it made it really hard to remember why I love magic in the first place. So my answer was to take everything back to first principles and to just start. So I ended up traveling to India, but I didn't go there on tour. I wasn't there to do my show. I was just there to sort of rediscover how it feels to myself be amazed by things. And
did it work?
It did, but not in the way I expected it. I went there. The reason I picked India was because on that leg of the tour, I was reading this. It was an academic text about traditional Indian street magic. And I just, you know, every culture has its own version of that sort of archetypal figure of the magician, right? And so the magic of any culture is a cultural expression, just like food or art or music, right? Every culture has its own tradition of magic. So had I been reading a book about ancient Japanese magic, I would have gone to Japan, or, you know, but I just happened to be reading a book about ancient Indian magic. And so I went there with the mission statement of seeing all of these feats of magic, snake charming, fire breathing, and thinking that in those performances, I would sort of remember how it felt to be in the audience watching a magic show. And I found all of those people and I watched all of those performances and they were amazing. But far more amazing than any of the magic that I saw was the process of searching for it and putting myself so far off balance. And, you know, the thing that both magic and travel do so well is they can deliver this cataclysmic death blow to any sense of certainty about the world or your place in the world. And that process of getting thoroughly lost was as amazing for me as any of the magic that I saw.
After that trip, did you feel like you're connection to wonder and amazement and magic itself was restored?
Yeah. I mean, I felt like on that trip, like my brain was set on fire. I became so captivated with the idea of not just finding wonder in the extraordinary, but in the quotidian and in the day-to-day. And, you know, it's one thing to feel amazed when you're wading in the Ganges River as it pours out of the Himalayan mountains, but it's another thing to bring that home with you. And so the question for me became not so much where do you find wonder or how do you find wonder, but how can you find it every day in your daily life? And so, you know, that affected everything that I've done since. It certainly changed the direction of my work as a magician, but it also was the motivation to learn how to write and to take that seriously. You know, I worried that I wouldn't be able to put all of the ideas that I was having into my magic show. And so I thought, if I can't communicate that way, I've got to figure out something else.
And so you started writing a book.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, that was in 2009. And I, for the next 4 years, as I was working as a magician, I would go back to my hotel room and I would just write. And for a while, I didn't know what I was writing. I was writing just to write, just to put sentences together and learn how words bump into one another and why one kind of sentence is more effective in this place than another kind of sentence. And just in the same way that I tried to learn how to be a magician, I was trying to figure out how to communicate with language. And
you said that everyone has this ability to see the wonder in the moment, to be amazed. But how do people actually access that? do you think? Yeah. I mean, do you have to go see a magic show? Do you have to go to India? Like, how do you tell people that they should behave? What should people do?
I'm not trying to convert anybody to anything, but sure. I have discovered a few sort of mental hacks that work for me, and I've noticed just in my own heart and in my own mind how easy it is to live in the story that I'm telling myself about the world and my place in the world rather than the world itself. You know, I have this constant narrative running in the background of, this is Nate. This is what Nate does. This is how Nate thinks. These are the things Nate likes. And I became aware when I was there how much of that was just fiction, like just me feeling that way because that's the story I decided on. And so I've found that anything that can shake me out of that is just extraordinarily useful for reconnecting with a sense of, you know, it's like I use the word wonder, but that's not actually quite right. Like it's somewhere between wonder and awe and amazement and mystery. We might not have the right word for it, but anything that shifts your perspective from the immediate to the infinite, right? So he's older now, but when my son was three, he insisted that every night before bed, we'd go outside and say goodnight to the stars. And it sounds like a cliche until you make that part of your daily routine. And then it just becomes a revelation that, you know, they're always there. We ignore them almost all the time, but just this daily reminder to not worry about the dishes or the dog or the, you know, all of the other things that need to go and just stop and breathe and look up for a minute. That to me is just incredible. You don't have to use tricks to do magic. And it's like he was showing me this thing that I could have seen on my own if I had remembered to look at it, but I would never have remembered to look at it if it wasn't for him wanting to do that. As to where you find it, you can find it in movies or music or basketball or mountaintops or conversations or poetry, or, you know, it's more about remembering to look than where you look. I think you can find it anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I have so many more questions and we only have a few more minutes. So I'm just going to end with this last question. For you, who is a favorite character in a book or a film? Can be fiction, nonfiction, but what is a character that you really resonate with?
Oh, man. This is a terrible answer because it's a magician character. So it's maybe too obvious, but my favorite book of all of the books in the world is called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by a woman named Susanna Clarke. And it's this historical fiction set in the Napoleonic Wars, except that in this version of history, there's such a thing as real magic. And Jonathan Strange is a magician who's using his magic against the French. And it's just, the whole book is shot through with insight and mystery and revelation. I don't know how she did it. It's like she knows more about magic than any other magician I've ever met. And yeah, if I had to pick one character, Jonathan Strange.
Would you like to be Jonathan Strange in the Napoleonic era?
He could do some pretty cool shit, Joe. I'm not going to lie. That'd be hard to turn down.
Wow. That sounds amazing. Okay, so tell us one more time the title of that book.
It's called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. It came out through Bloomsbury in, I want to say, 2003. Wow. And it's a monster of a book. It's one of those books that's just like an ocean and you get lost in it. I've read it every year since it's come out and I keep discovering new things in it.
Oh, so my goodness.
I honestly don't know how she did it. It's just a miracle of a book.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Nate. This has been so much fun. I wish we had another hour so I could ask you so many more questions.
Thanks for having me on, Joe. It's good speaking with you.
So your book is called Here is Real Magic, and you can get it at any place books are sold. And Nate, where else can people find you online?
I'm terrible at social media. I would give you my Twitter handle, but I tweet 2 or 3 times a year. Honestly, like, I think the book is the best way. I'm not going to give you a better representation of myself than the book, I think. But I'm also working on a YouTube series as well. So if you want to do something right away, you can just search for me on YouTube and there I'll be.
Great. And the book is amazing. Everyone should read it. It helped me reconnect with my own work. So thank you again for writing it and for sharing it with us. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
All right, let's get into our character study segment of the show. This is where we ask what we can learn from Nate's story and apply to our own lives as we try to live a better story. All right, Alice, what was your takeaway?
Oh, I had a lot of takeaways from this episode. I thought that it was a really cool conversation. But what I found most striking, I think, and maybe most easily, quickly applicable to my own life, was this concept of always pushing yourself into spaces of discomfort. I thought it was really powerful to hear about how he set up this stage show that he ran for 6 months when he was just getting started. And it went really, really poorly. But he also didn't waste that time. He used that really intentionally in the middle of that discomfort to spend every minute studying magic, to spend every minute pushing himself forward. Because he's in this really uncomfortable space, and it would either have been an opportunity to bail or an opportunity to press in deeper. And how he's not in that same kind of uncomfortable space anymore. He's got a lot more stability. He's got a lot more traction in his career. But he still talked about how whenever he feels like he's got a handle on things, that's an invitation, a red flag that he should push deeper into a space where he feels like he's a little over his head. It resonated a little too much, the bad shows and the shows where he goes on stage feeling like, I got this. It's going to go well. It's easy. I don't have to worry about it. Because I've definitely had moments like that in my own life. It's a little annoying, you know, to be like the moments where you are most confident and so become complacent are the moments where things start to go poorly in new ways. But I found it an inspiring challenge that he thinks of it in terms of as soon as you get comfortable, change, change something. Comfort, while there are levels of desirability, is also an invitation to change and more challenge.
Yeah, I just relate to that whole story in the theater in LA so much. And, you know, I think for me as a writer, I had to go through that period of life too, where I was kind of struggling to make it, trying to learn the craft, my craft, which is writing. And really, it wasn't easy, you know? I wasn't really succeeding in my career. I wasn't, you know, thriving in a lot of ways. And yet I still look back at that time with this nostalgia, because there was something sweet about the level of focus that you have in that place. And I think that's kind of the hidden part of a lot of, you know, the great writers, great artists, great performers in history, their journey is that period of grinding when they're not really out in the public's eye. They're kind of doing things at a very high level. They're just trying to get through it and make it. And they're just grinding. And it's hard. It's not easy, especially when you're in that place. It can be really discouraging. Before we started recording, he told me a little bit about the YouTube channel that he's working on. And just how hard it was in this new space of YouTube, which he hasn't, you know, really mastered yet. He's doing good work, but like, it's still a challenge. He hasn't made it. He doesn't have a lot of followers, and it's just hard. And I totally relate to that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we started this podcast, because I needed a new challenge. And now we're in this place, and he's in this place of grinding. You know,
for sure.
Where you have to show up and you do the work, and it doesn't always get a lot of traction. And it's part of learning the form and learning the process and attracting people. But, you know, it's hard. It's discouraging. I was telling a friend, and this may be a little too honest, but just how I was feeling discouraged about this podcast. And, you know, it's just a lot of work. And it doesn't always feel like the reward is always there. And yet he was encouraging me and said, I think you're on to something. You just need to keep grinding. And I thought that was such great advice. And I think every artist understands that grind. Anyone who's made it understands that grind, because you're doing the work alone so much of the time. And it's hard. And it's kind of embarrassing because it's not always succeeding like you expect it should. But this is where the real work is done.
Yeah. You say anyone who's made it understands the grind, which makes me think about how of the people who haven't made it, some of the people who haven't made it, the reason why is because they bailed on the grind.
Yeah. And Nate said, like, I'm always trying to get into situations where all I have to do is outlast them.
You know? Yes.
I don't know if he said that in the interview or like beforehand, but his goal is just to outlast people. And as a writer, so many people want to write books, but all you have to do is keep outlasting all the people who are just getting into it because it's fun.
Yeah. I don't know if he used exactly those words on the interview that was recorded, but I did hear him say something along the lines of, you don't need talent to be a good magician.
Yeah.
You just need to work harder and longer than anybody else who's trying to be a good magician. Right. The rest of them will fall away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not easy.
No.
But
for sure.
But I think it is the secret to success, if there is one.
Yeah.
And it's not really a secret. It's just hard, sucky work.
It's the secret in that a lot of us don't necessarily want to look it in the face.
Yeah.
So totally. We don't allow ourselves to believe that necessarily. What's your takeaway?
Yeah, I mean, I just relate to his whole life so much. So, I mean, we have a very similar career trajectory, I think. This dream to do something really competitive, a lot of people want to be magicians, but there's only, you know, space in our economy for X number of magicians, and it's not a lot, you know? You know, there's not a lot of people spending a lot of money on magicians. And the same is true for writers, you know? The economy can only support so many writers, but a lot of people want to be writers. So just that dream to do something in those fields. And also, at the same time, you know, what it feels like to finally accomplish that dream. He accomplished his dream. He was a professional magician. He still is. I accomplished my dream to be a writer, still am. And at the same time, it wasn't as magical as we thought. Just doing that wasn't quite enough. There's still kind of that emptiness, it's not the right word, but just like unsatisfaction. You think, once I get to this place, I will be satisfied, I will be content. And then you get to that place and you're like, oh, well, I'm still not, you know, there's still so much further to go. And I think that's a discouraging thing. I think that happens in every career, not just in the arts. I think that happens to everyone. But the question is, like, how do you reconnect with wonder, especially when that wonder is your job? You know, for him, it was his job. For me, it's my job. How do you stay open to it? I don't know. I just relate to it so much.
Yeah.
And I love how he just was honest about that struggle and, you know, did something about it.
Yeah. I thought on this note of having this dream of creativity and a market that only supports so much of it, I thought it was fascinating to hear about how it's really hard for actors to break into the industry. It's really hard for musicians to break into the industry. Like, I've heard about how hard those are. And he talked about how much harder it is to be a musician or a magician. That's like the fourth time that you and I have done that.
So
a
funny.
Magician, because there's no established trajectory, like even for the really difficult path that actors and musicians take, there is an established trajectory. And for a magician, he had to create his own world, essentially, to make it work. It was really powerful.
One of the unseen things in that too is the relationships, because I know from talking to him previously, like the relationships that he has with other working magicians. And I think you learn your craft and you learn your business from other people in that same industry, whether you're a salesman or a writer or a magician, apparently, you have to have those relationships with other people. And I don't know, I always think that's really important and kind of unseen.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was really cool. It was a really good interview. Good talk.
Thanks. Pat myself on the back for it.
There you go.
All right. So your character test challenge today is just to reconnect with wonder. Maybe you go for a walk. Maybe you have some time meditating. Whatever that looks like for you, just look around and try to just be open to wonder, to this idea that the things that are around you are amazing, that they're powerful. Reconnect with wonder, whatever that looks like for you. Try to spend at least like 10 minutes doing that. And then let us know how it goes. You can email us at charactertestshow@gmail.com. That's it. That's our show. Thanks to Pictures of the Floating World for our theme music. Don't forget to go to charactertestshow.com/episode14 for your free prize. And also, we need your help. We need more reviews on our podcast. That would be a huge help for us. So please go to your podcast player, wherever you get your podcasts, find whatever button you need to leave a review, then write a review. It can be as short as one sentence and click submit. It'll take you 30 seconds to leave a review, but it'll be a huge help for us. Thank you so much.